Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jonathan White for the Center for Inclusive Design and Environmental Access. So tell me a little bit about the IDEA Center.
Well, the IDEA Center is a multidisciplinary research center at the University of Buffalo School of Architecture and Planning. We have architects and planners, of course, but we also have occupational therapists, behavioral scientists, industrial engineers as well working with us. Our goal is to increase adoption of universal design. Familiar with what that is?
Yes, but perhaps you could take the audience through for those who might not be as familiar.
All right, so our mission is really to make environments and products more usable, safer, and healthier, and to do that for everybody. So universal design is about basically good design that makes life easier, healthier, friendlier and safer for all people, as opposed to accessible design, which would be about just making accommodations for specific groups of people. And we do this both for the built environment, buildings, public rights of way, and also product design as well.
So can you give me an overview of some of the products that you work with?
Let's see here. What would be some good examples? I'm not the person who's on products. I'm an architectural designer. We do research on product design. So, like, we've done research on, like, kitchen products, like usability of microwaves or kitchen utensils and that sort of thing, done studies on. We've also done studies on products that are more in the accessible design realm, like lifts and that sort of thing for buses and vans. We have looked at like comfort and grip on like handheld products, but again, kitchen utensils and that sort of thing. In the past, I know we've done some studies where we looked at some toys as well, but I was, that was probably at least 10 years ago. I've been with the center for 8. We also look at we have partnerships, like industry partnerships. So one product that was put out is an interactive touch map of different museums or different schools. So, for example, the Carroll Center for the Blind has a map, a tactile map that you can touch, and then it tells you what the building is, and you can feel your roots. So people, the students there could get oriented to the campus. But there are other versions of that in different museums, and I can't recall one off the top of my head. I think the Smithsonian or something was interested. I don't know if they have one yet or they were interested. But it's a universal design because it works for everybody. So they can put this giant 3D map of the complex, in the atrium, and everybody can go up and touch it. And then it'll also not only will it tell you what building you're touching, but it shows it on a screen, and then you can hit a button and get more information. also has like a visual element to it, so that there's a lit, like a, the current incarnations have like a projector that projects different things down onto the map, so it's also a visual as well. So it's all these many different ways of communicating in this one product, and our partner with that is Touch Graphics. So just some examples of what we're working with. What else are we working on now? Some signage, so signs next to doors, making those more readable. For like smartphones, so creating like a chip that would go in signs that would be inexpensive, that anyone with a smartphone could go and hold it up to the sign, and it would, your phone could read to you what's in the room. So that's another example of a product that we work on.
So are there any challenges in creating universal design when you factor in what could be a need of a person with a disability?
Well, I think that the challenges are really specific to, you know, what you're working with. So if it's a building, the challenges are going to be getting people to understand what universal design is and getting all the architects and everybody on board. They think that maybe, oh, well, we've got this code. In America, we have the ADA, your equivalent, I guess, the AODA. Are you Ontario or are you?
Yes.
You're in Ontario?
Windsor.
So you'd have the AODA up there. You know, if an architect comes and reads the code, they think that that's all they need to do, and that's not really universal design, because, you know, it might not be the primary entrance that's the accessible entrance, at least in the ADA. I'm not too familiar with AODA. So it's getting past the barriers of, and getting people to realize that it's not necessarily more expensive, and if it is, it's well worth it. You know, in the cases where it might be more expensive. And so it's trying to get people to understand what universal design is and just think outside the box. So that's a challenge that we would face. So what are some good examples of that? In a workspace, providing individual and adjustable seating options so that there's not just one desk, but maybe everybody's got a desk that can adjust up and down to fit their height. You know, that's not for people with disabilities, although it would help people with disabilities, but it's not required by the ADA to have an adjustable desk. It's just they have certain heights that you have to provide, and you have to accommodate your employees. But if everybody has an adjustable height desk, then people could stand up and work if they want and get off their feet and promote health that way. So it's just getting people to think of these things outside the box and getting that information to them, I think, is one of the bigger challenges with universal design. Another challenge is, of course, when you're designing for everybody, there's always somebody that's going to fall outside of what you design that's not going to be usable for. And so it's tough, you know, to design for somebody who's tall at the same time as designing for somebody who's really short, right? Because if you just pick the middle, then everybody's sort of not quite accommodated. And so you have to think outside the box, come up with options. Well, could this be adjustable in height so it accommodates everybody, that sort of thing. Sometimes that can be difficult, trying to design for both sides of the bell curve.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time working in universal design, has there been any success that stood out for you?
Success. Well, we're currently, some of our research, this is really more so for just wheel mobility users, but some of our research is making its way into standards, into the ANSI, A-N-S-I standard for accessibility. And so the next standard that comes out will be more accommodating to people with disabilities, just because it looks at more recent research. The research that initially formed those type of standards was done with a sample size of, I think, 60. I wouldn't necessarily quote me on that, but it was somewhere in that range, about 60 people or so. That was done back in the 1970s when most people had manual wheelchairs. And they were almost all the same manual wheelchair. So now we've got so much different technology We did a research study with 500 different participants, all sorts of different sized wheelchairs and power wheelchairs and scooters, and we, you know, looked at the standards and saw, well, where are they accommodated? Just in the basic building blocks of the standard, basic size and turning abilities, reachability. And we've made some headway into the standards of getting them to change some of their standards and be a little more accommodating. Of course, it's always a bit of a back and forth with them, you know, because the industry, of course, doesn't want things to change because then they have to redesign what they're doing and do things a little differently. So there's pushback in terms of changing standards. Well, we have the standard. We've been using the standard for years. Sometimes the industry doesn't want to change. And so sometimes you have to have a little give and take. But we presented our research to them, and they're accommodating some of that research as their latest version of the standard. So that's one success we've had. Another success, we're developing universal design standards, and this is a little different for public buildings anyway. And these are a little different than accessibility standards in that they don't prescribe a certain minimum number, otherwise that just becomes the minimum. But these universal design standards have those suggestive tips about adjustability and all those other things, and making sure that everybody is using the same entrance, that you know, everyone can all go in the same entrance that everyone else uses, so that so those standards that we're developing are getting a lot of interest from larger companies who have non-disclosure agreements, so I can't talk about who they are, but very big product manufacturers that you would recognize the names to, and they would they want to use these standards in designing their, you know, corporate buildings, their corporate office parks, in their buildings, so that they're accommodating for their employees. They also want to sort of take on this philosophy in their product design as well. So I think that's a pretty good success story when we have these large companies signing on to start testing out some of the draft versions of our universal design standards that are coming out at some point.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yeah, no problem.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women, 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know." Only question now is, what will you do? Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Jonathan White from the Idea Center. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Dr. Alice Maynard from Future Inclusion. So, tell me a little bit about Future Inclusion.
Well, Future Inclusion is my company. It was set up in 2003 when I came out of the transport industry. And I set it up in order to give myself greater freedom to do things that really interested me and be more public about some of the things that I thought around transport and wanted to say about it.
And this would include things such as transportation issues for people with disabilities.
That's absolutely right. But also for other people as well, from what we call over here minority groups. So people from Black, Asian and minority ethnic groups, women in as much as women constitute a political minority, people of a different sexual orientation, anyone who is traditionally excluded from the transport industry, but in particular that's going to be disabled people just because that's the way it works, or doesn't.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the work that has gone on since Future Inclusion began?
Well, in the end, actually, I didn't entirely, or haven't entirely focused on transport. Transport has always been a key theme, but there have been other things as well as transport. So, for instance, I worked for some time with my old employer, Network Rail, just making sure that they kept the issue of transport exclusion from their own services high on their agenda. So I did things like help them out with certain major projects around the redesign of certain stations, and around their generic policies on the support that they provide for disabled people at the stations which they run. I did some work with some of the train companies on franchise bids to make sure that they properly included disabled people's issues and the issues of other people who are transport excluded in their bids, so that when they came, they made the right kinds of commitments, if I can put it that way, in their bids for transport. I don't know if you know how the rail industry works over here, but it's a bit complicated. Somebody owns the track and somebody else owns the trains and somebody else runs the trains, and the way it's all put together is a little bit challenging, let's say, particularly from a disabled person's perspective, because there is almost literally in the law and in practice a gap between the platform and the train itself. So it was a question of kind of keeping people's minds on that. I've done work for the Greater London Authority. We did some research into the needs of disabled people in housing and in post-16 education. So various different sorts of things, but mainly transport related.
So in your work for the disabled community, has there been any success moment that stood out for you?
I think that right towards the very beginning, the work that I was doing on strategy for accessibility across the whole rail network resulted in something called Access for All. And that was a really big moment in terms of the government saying, okay, then we will put some money into making stations more accessible across the rail network. So that was really important. I think some of the things in that I've done with Transport for London, where we had something called a citizens' jury, where 12 people with different impairments from across London had the opportunity to cross-examine, as it were, some of Transport for London's directors and ask them what they were planning on doing for disabled people. And although nothing amazing happened immediately as a result of that, I think the impact that had on the directors and on the ongoing work of the organization is one of the things that's made quite a big difference.
So.
There have been a few things that have been quite significant. We did some work with Habinteg Housing Association. It's one of the housing associations in the UK that provides what we call social housing, which is housing for people that find it difficult to afford to buy their own homes or rent privately. And they decided that they wanted to put together what was called a disability equality scheme. It was something that they didn't have to do, because you only had to do that if you were a public sector organisation, and they didn't have to do it. But they decided they wanted to lead the housing sector by demonstrating their commitment to disability and disabled people. And that was very important in terms of the way in which the housing sector thought about disabled people, disability, the rights of disabled tenants, and so on. So there have been some really interesting moments throughout. But I think most people that work in this field would agree that that a lot of it is just about long, slow slog, really. And you can look back over 20 years or sometimes 5 or 10, but usually more like 20, and say, yeah, okay, that really made a difference, and we have made some progress. Sometimes it doesn't feel as if you're making any progress at all, but sometimes you can look back away and go, yeah, things are different, they're better.
So if you could send any one message about the need for equal access, what would you say?
I would say that disabled people are equal citizens. We may not be treated as such, but we are. We are worth as much as the person standing next to us. And so we should be treated as such. And actually, if people don't treat us as such, they will have something to answer for in the future. And I would really respect and praise those who take a stand in organisations and say, no, I'm going to do this differently. I'm going to make sure that in our organisation we make change happen and we deliver a better service for disabled people.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
It's a pleasure.
I think she had it exactly right during the interview, in so much as individuals with disabilities are to be treated equally. And things such as the citizens jury she mentioned, getting people with disabilities together, talk about not only their needs, their hopes within the community, but also to say very publicly they have a right to inclusion. That is exactly what it's all about. It's much, much more difficult to say you don't have this right or we're not going to support you when you're right in front of someone. When they can put a human face to disability life. They can look you in the eye and say, we know what we're supposed to do, but we're not going to do it. It's much, much more difficult at that point. But knowing the rights of a person with a disability is important not only for society, but for the individual themselves. Groups like Disability Rights Promotion International are working to make sure that such people know what's supposed to be in place for them. It's easy for governments and organizations to say, we're going to meet the minimum standard, but that's all we're going to do. And even then, are people asking the questions? Are our ideals really matching our practices? It says on paper there should be this level of access, but is there really? I would encourage anyone with a disability who does have a question in this area, look into it, ask, make sure things are as they should be. Progress is never made by people keeping silent. Truth of the matter is, we as a society need to look at disability in the larger context. If we're denying access to one group, individuals with disabilities, how much easier is it to go down this slippery slope to where no one's rights, no one finds the level of access they're looking for? We as a society worked very hard to get out of such practices, and it's an evolution. It's constantly going forward. I'm lucky, I see it all the time. People with disabilities being included in greater and greater measure. Just recently, I heard about a model with Down syndrome who was making a very public face for people affected by the condition. But the truth is, it should never be an afterthought. People with disabilities should be included for the same reason that anyone else should be. Because they are talented, hopeful, intelligent people within our community, and they have something to contribute. We shouldn't just do it as an image thing or say, we tossed a turkey bone, aren't we great? Disability life is about meaningful and real support, recognizing that day to day, it's about making the community better. And that's what both interviews really touched on today, that it's not just about those immediately affected. It's about all of us. And the truth is, the more we go forward, the more we dispel these myths and stereotypes, the easier it is for the world to look upon what's really there in a person with a disability. You know what's really there? Capability, potentials, hopes, dreams. It's all a question of taking the time, making the effort to find the right way to reach such a person. And these people, they're not strangers. People with disabilities are in every walk of life. Every family, somewhere, sometime, has had someone with a disability. That's just a question of recognition. But I'm always grateful when I hear something such as Future Inclusion or the Idea Center making progress for people with disabilities. But also bearing in mind that their potential is everyone's potential. If a person with a disability is included equally in society, who's to say they won't come up with the next big innovation, or they won't be an advocate for equal rights for all, or that universal design can't benefit not just the immediately intended audience, but that it can't be better for all of us. Equal inclusion is not just about building up people with disabilities or other minority groups. It is about creating a better, more respectful society. It is about creating for the future and understanding that we must never rest on our laurels, we must never say, we've put this policy or this adaptation in place and it's good enough, let's stop there. It's about seeing what's next. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.